This is Mayo Clinic Talks, a curated weekly podcast for physicians and healthcare providers. I'm your host, Daryl Chutka, a general internist at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. Although esophageal cancer is not that common, when it's found, it often has a rather poor prognosis. It's about 4 times more likely to occur in a male than a female, and although a variety of malignancies can develop in the esophagus, most tend to be either squamous cell or adenocarcinoma. Fortunately, the rates of esophageal cancer have been decreasing slightly over the past decade. Despite the fact that esophageal cancer often produces symptoms, the survival rate has not been very good, although due to improved treatments, it has been improving. The topic for today's podcast is esophageal cancer, and my guest is Dr. Tanios Bikai-Saab, the Division Chair for Hematology Oncology at the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix, Arizona. We'll discuss the risk factors for esophageal cancer, its common presenting symptoms, how to establish a diagnosis, and the various treatment options available. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Talks. Tanios, welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Daryl. It's a pleasure to be on this podcast today.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how common esophageal cancer is. I've been in practice over 40 years, and I can only think of maybe a handful of my patients who've developed this. How does it compare with other GI malignancies in terms of its frequency?
No, absolutely. Esophageal cancer is a rare type of cancer. When you look at actually all cancer cases, it's about 1% of all cases in the United States. It's one of the less common gastrointestinal cancers, but also one of the rare cancers overall. When we look at the number of cases diagnosed, they're about either in the 20,000s. Unfortunately, when we look at the death, it's about matched, which is a result of the poor prognosis and the aggressive nature of this cancer. Now, if we look worldwide, this is actually not an uncommon cancer. It's the 8th most commonly diagnosed cancer, and actually one of the most common leading cause of cancer death. However, in the United States, it's one of the less common types of cancer.
Okay. Now, I know that there's a variety of malignancies that can occur in the esophagus, you know, sarcoma, even melanoma, but the two most predominant types are squamous cell and adenocarcinoma, and those are kind of pretty much distinctly different. Can you review those two and how they differ?
Yes, indeed. They are different. The etiology is different. And also that leads us ultimately that there are some common aspects of, at least when it comes to treatment, and some divergences. But when it comes to risk factors, it's important to understand that in the United States and Western America overall, squamous cell carcinoma has become less and less common. So it has essentially, in terms of incidence, gone down significantly, whereby we've seen a rise in the Western part of the world, specifically in the United States, of adenocarcinoma. And that's primarily driven also by location. You know, as you know, they can go all the way through the esophagus. Adenocarcinoma in the U.S. are mostly in the lower esophagus and GE junction, squamous cell, usually higher up. Geography matters. So for squamous cell carcinoma, we're going to see that mostly in Africa, parts of Asia, South America. When we look at gender, it's predominantly male for both. Now, squamous cell carcinoma is typically seen in patients who drink a lot and smoke a lot, do both. So tobacco and alcohol, less so with adenocarcinoma. Now, we see adenocarcinoma mostly with obesity. So we've seen actually a significant rise of gastroesophagus adenocarcinoma, primarily in patients in the United States, primarily in the Midwest, where we've seen a lot more obesity. But also that has been associated also with reflux, acid reflux disease. So going in then, so acid reflux disease ends up being, along with other factors, but primarily acid reflux disease appears to be the primary driver for adenocarcinoma, not so much for squamous cell carcinoma.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about acid reflux since you mentioned it. I think that's one of the conditions we worry about in terms of whether a patient is at risk for future esophageal cancer, and we often try hard to relieve or prevent its symptoms. How should we be managing patients who present to us with symptoms of chronic acid reflux?
I think the most important piece to understand is that most people, not the overwhelming majority of folks with acid reflux, will not get cancer. However, people with acid reflux will have a slightly higher risk of getting adenocarcinoma of the esophagus. But there are also other risk factors, so it's not just on its own. However, it's a driving force if you want to think about it as such. And there are other factors also that go into the equation. The risk seems to be highest in people who have more frequent symptoms. So if you have the occasional heart, reflux because you've, eaten a spicy enchilada, a one-off or two-off, that's not necessarily as much of a concern that someone that gets it all the time or pretty much most of the time. These are the patients that are at the highest risk for developing cancer. Now, we know because reflux is actually pretty common. It's not uncommon. Mm-hmm. And most of the people who have it, as I said, do not go on to developing cancer of the esophagus. Now, the other thing that reflux or chronic reflux would do, it would cause a phenomenon called Barrett's esophagus. And we can talk a little bit about that. Now, Barrett's esophagus as well is linked to an even higher risk. So you can have reflux leading to cancer. You can have reflux leading to Barrett's, which leads to even a higher risk of cancer. So you don't need Barrett's esophagus as the obligatory intermediary between reflux and cancer, but if there is evidence of Barrett's, the risk of cancer is even higher. So in terms of what do we do? As I said, for the typical heartburn or a little bit of regurgitation, those patients do not necessarily need an upper endoscopy. The upper endoscopy would become important if a patient has acid reflux for reasons that are unknown, like I said, spicy food or something that we know triggers or the patient knows triggers. But also more importantly, if there are also some what we call alarm features, these have been described about a decade ago, that includes dysphagia, so difficulty swallowing, weight loss, losing weight, vomiting, and of course, anemia is a trigger because that indicates, evidence of bleeding and the risk for cancer, or there is an abnormal imaging, incidental or not. At that time, upper endoscopy would be important to screen for two things. One, to screen for Barrett's esophagus, but also screen for adenocarcinoma.
Okay. So you mentioned that a very small percentage of patients with chronic acid reflux go on to develop adenocarcinoma of the esophagus. Can you turn that around? Do the vast majority of patients who have adenocarcinoma, have they had acid reflux?
Yes, especially adenocarcinoma. So again, to separate squamous from adeno, the answer is clearly yes, that those patients with adenocarcinoma, especially of the GE junction, have a very high incidence linking them to a history of reflux disease. Absolutely.
Okay. The patient who has reflux symptoms either daily or at least five times per week, is our goal to keep them symptom-free?
Being symptom-free, meaning that you have to do a lot of adjustments, of lifestyle adjustments, losing weight, exercise, smoking and alcohol to cut down on those. And of course, ensuring that they get the proper screening. And screening oftentimes is lifetime, especially in those patients who actually have evidence of Barrett's esophagus.
So let's talk more about Barrett's. Describe exactly what's going on in a patient who has Barrett's esophagus.
Yes, in the U.S. and in other parts of the world, the diagnosis of Barrett's esophagus following an endoscopy, because that's how we establish it, depends on visualization as well as histologic examination of biopsy samples. There'll be some degree of metaplasia, but also possibly some degrees of dysplasia, low grade and high grade, which can lead to adenocarcinoma. Now, the majority, again, I will note that the majority of patients with adenocarcinoma of the esophagus, so about 90% or so, do not have prior Barrett's esophagus diagnosis. Now, although Barrett's esophagus increases the risk even higher, it's not a necessity to develop adenocarcinoma of the esophagus. That's why it's very important for physicians and patients to understand that the symptoms of GERD, so of reflux disease and associated symptoms, are quite important in terms of determining those patients at highest risk. But when we think about Barrett's esophagus, and we're thinking about the continuum from metaplasia to low-grade dysplasia to high-grade dysplasia, and then esophageal adenocarcinoma. And also understanding that most Barrett's will not necessarily progress to high-grade dysplasia or esophageal adenocarcinoma. So for those patients with Barrett's esophagus, let's say, you know, we have 1,000 patients diagnosed with Barrett's esophagus, about 3 to 5 perhaps will progress ultimately to esophageal cancer. Now, I still think this is a large number, frankly, 3 to 5 out of 1,000. But it's important to note that more than 995 patients will not develop esophageal cancer. Now, as we move to dysplasia, this is where we start seeing that risk go up even further. So with high-grade dysplasia, up to 20% of the patients per year can develop esophageal adenocarcinoma. Now, that's important because that means 1 out of every 5 patients with high-grade dysplasia in the setting of Barrett's esophagus will develop adenocarcinoma of the esophagus. With a low-grade dysplasia, that can go closer to 10%. So it's not insignificant, but lower. So in that sense, you know, when we think about the extent of reflux disease and patients that could develop Barrett's esophagus, we're talking about 1% per patient per year as a reasonable estimate in the U.S. population. So that's a lot of patients at risk with that.
I think there's a lot of confusion out there amongst primary care clinicians. I see patients who have had an endoscopy which revealed Barrett's with either no dysplasia or low-grade dysplasia, and they're getting an upper endoscopy almost every year. That's really not necessary, is it?
It's not. Some of the recommendations relate to the segment. If it's actually a long segment Barrett, which is about more or equal than 3 centimeters, a short segment would be less than that. For the long segment Barrett's esophagus, we're going to screen about every 3 years. Or if you want to really be aggressive, it'll be every couple of years, but it's every 3 years. And for the short segment, it's actually every 5 years. Now, this is pertaining to those with just metaplasia and not dysplasia. Now, you will get more aggressive in the presence of dysplasia, which, you know, is a less common instance. But the presence of just Barrett's with metaplasia, depending on the length of the segment, so your screening is between 3 to 5 years. Long 3, short 5.
Okay. And how about high-grade dysplasia?
So high-grade dysplasia, again, the literature is pretty varied, but it could be anywhere between every 6 months to every year. Understanding that the risk of developing cancer with high-grade dysplasia can be up to 20% per year.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So other than referring a patient for endoscopy, is there a reason we should be referring patients with Barrett's to possibly a gastroenterology?
Not necessarily so. So other than for endoscopy, I think, you know, primary care physicians, internists, family doctors can certainly manage those patients in the interim.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about the symptoms. How does esophageal cancer present? What are the most common presenting symptoms?
So once patients develop cancer of the esophagus, so esophageal cancer, which is said in the United States most commonly in the lower esophagus and the gastroesophageal junction, the symptoms are typically, you would expect them to be dysphagia with weight loss. Odynophagia is usually a little bit more of an ominous sign. You know, that usually says, it tells us that the cancer is a little bit more progressed. Of course, heartburn, reflux, as we said, you know, most of these patients will have history of heartburn that actually gets worse, which makes sense because, you know, you disrupt essentially that valve between the stomach and the esophagus. Pain, pressure, but weight loss, most of these patients will lose unintended weight, both from the cancer and from the lack of adequate nutrition, and of course, reduced appetite. And for few patients, we may see melanoma.
Is the dysphagia that patients get with esophageal cancer more of a distal esophageal symptom rather than high in the throat?
So interestingly, for squamous cell, it can be in the cervical esophagus or a little bit higher up. For the adenocarcinomas, it's primarily in the lower, although, you know, we see some mid, but most of them are actually in the lower esophagus and the G junction. So when the patient comes in, you know, they're referring to difficulty swallowing, it's getting stuck somewhere above the epigastric area or around the epigastric area.
Okay. So we have a patient with symptoms we suspect could represent early esophageal cancer. What do we do next? What are the best diagnostic tests that we should order?
So now it's important. So first test will be an endoscopy, an upper endoscopy. So for direct visualization and the number of ways to do direct visualization without going through the technicalities, but direct visualization with a biopsy of any suspicious lesions, or in rare occasions, you know, it may be flat, it may be just changes in the epithelium. So biopsies in the area that look suspicious. So once this diagnosis is established, then we go through staging the patient, and staging scans would be warranted. Of course, you know, the routine labs and all that stuff, mm-hmm. but staging scans would be warranted just to assess the extent of the disease. And this is our Mayo standard, at least if it looks like the disease is localized, meaning that there is no evidence of metastatic disease in organs, then an endoscopic ultrasound would ensue. And that's important because that will give us an idea about the extent, the depth of the tumor, as well as any regional lymph node involvement. And typically what we do next is a PET CT, a PET scan, to essentially, again, confirm what we use it for two reasons. One, to confirm, again, that there is no evidence of metastatic disease that we may have missed on the scans. But the other thing also is to assess the activity within the tumor that we're going to treat as we go through, you know, how we approach the treatment, especially if the cancer is localized. I wouldn't do a PET scan unless I have evidence of localized disease or suspected localized disease. A PET scan has not much of value in this setting for metastatic disease, meaning if I get a scan and I see liver lesions that are suspicious, I'm going to forego the endoscopic ultrasound because at that point we will not need local staging, but also I'll forego a PET scan because we've established the presence of metastatic disease. There's also one element with performing an upper endoscopy initially with biopsies. If the dysphagia is very severe and there's an element of adenophagia, may consider placing a stent in place to allow essentially for patients to enhance their oral intake.
Okay. In localized disease, is the depth of invasion related to survival?
Yes, absolutely. So when we think about cancer of the esophagus, we're thinking about localized, regional, and distant disease. But even within the localized disease, the deeper the tumor is, so T1, T2, T3, T4, the lower the likelihood of survival. The presence of lymph nodes regionally also lower the likelihood of survival. So with localized overall, it's about 50%. But if the tumor is a T1 or a T1S or a T2, the likelihood of survival is much higher, 70, 80%. If it's a T3 plus, the likelihood of survival drops down. If there are lymph nodes, we're looking at 25 to 30% survival. Although I will tell you that those numbers are improving significantly. These numbers, you know, of course, you know, change decade by decade. We have a tail. We were looking at the last 10 years and things are changing actually year by year. And for the distant disease, you know, we're about 6 to 10% 5-year survival rate.
Why does esophageal cancer have such a relatively low survival rate? Do most patients present with more than localized disease?
About a little bit less than half of the patients will present with metastatic disease, at least distant. Most patients will present with more advanced localized disease. Unfortunately, most of them will also have a high risk of recurrence. There are also elements with morbidity that may prevent some patients who may be potentially cured to actually undergo extensive treatment that typically put patients through. So I think the low rate of survival is primarily linked to two things. One, that this disease is aggressive and it tends to spread early. But two, also patients tend to present later and tend to forego, I'm having extra reflux, maybe I've had, you know, a little bit more of spicy food, or I gained a little bit of weight, or I haven't been paying attention. We tend to brush off some of these symptoms. Many patients, unfortunately, are not routinely followed up by a primary care physician or a family doctor where they actually are being seen on a routine basis and being assessed for these various symptoms. So there are a lot of reasons why these also, by the way, a lot of these cancers, the squamous, obviously, you know, are mostly in the socioeconomically unfavorable group. You know, these tend to be patients who smoke more, who drink more, who pay less attention to their health. But also patients with adenocarcinoma tend to be also less health conscious in the sense they're more overweight. They also don't pay as much attention. So I think part of it is the lack of follow-up, but a lot of it also has to do with the fact that this cancer, by the time you have symptoms, i.e. symptoms of dysphagia or odynophagia, oftentimes it's already metastatic.
Okay. So what are the therapeutic options? What are the treatments available for a patient with esophageal cancer?
So of course, all depends on the stage. So the very, very early stage of the cancer, so the in situ, say, or high-grade dysplasia, there are local regional approaches that don't necessarily require surgery or local resection or local interventions at the site of the area that's dysplastic or has an in situ cancer. However, for most patients we see, the treatment actually will consist of, in the earlier stages, of either surgery alone, and these are the rare patients because they present incidentally, meaning their tumor is maybe T1 and no lymph nodes. But for most patients we see, they will require, again, in the localized and the regional stages, they will require chemotherapy and radiation, chemotherapy alone, followed by surgical resection. And whether we go through more chemotherapy or not will depend on the level of response to the preoperative treatment and on the capacity of the patient to receive more treatment. We've seen some data recently moving some of the immune therapy agents into the adjuvant setting. There's one study that was positive and one study that was, I would say, borderline positive. But there now there is a role for select patients for immune therapy in the adjuvant setting for those who may have received neoadjuvant treatment and have not achieved a really strong response. And we're looking in more and more into bringing immune therapy into the earlier stages and targeted therapies in the earlier stages. Now, for the majority of the patients we see, they are either metastatic at presentation or ultimately present with metastatic disease following neoadjuvant treatment and surgery. For those patients, you know, the armamentarium continues to expand quite significantly. Chemotherapy remains a very strong backbone of what we do for those patients, but now we have a number of agents that are entering the clinical world. We know that about 15% of the patients, for example, will overexpress HER2, similar to what we see with breast cancer, that HER2 overexpression will link the patients essentially to a monoclonal antibody called trastuzumab that's added to chemotherapy, significantly enhances the response and the likelihood of survival. We've had recent data that suggests you can combine immune therapy with this trastuzumab in those 10 to 15% of patients. And the response rates end up being about 80% with many, many patients essentially living 2 to 3 times longer than expected, meaning they can go 2-3 years on for some with excellent results. Immune therapy in the HER2 negative patients, immune therapy has again found its way with chemotherapy for about half of the patients who have essentially expression of a ligand that predicts for immune therapy response. We just recently also have another monoclonal antibody that combined with chemotherapy improves survival. That's an antibody targeting a protein called claudin, which is also overexpressed in a large percent of patients. And more biologics are starting to make their way in addition to immune therapies along with chemotherapy in the setting of esophageal cancer. And more therapies are becoming also available as salvage options, from VEGF inhibitors, so targeting angiogenesis, to multikinase inhibitors, to other forms of chemotherapy. So we're having access to a very rich portfolio of agents for these patients. And all that, by the way, happened over the last, 5 to 6 years, at least most of this incremental increase of agents available to us.
So I take it with the immunotherapy and the new treatment options available, you're optimistic about the future of the treatment of esophageal cancer.
Yes, absolutely. If we look at historically where we were at, there were 4 cancers where 5-year overall survival were less than 20% for all stages combined, and cancer of the esophagus was one of them. Now it's actually now in the getting closer to the 30+%. So in a couple of decades, we've moved 10-15% of patients from under 5 years to over 5 years survival.
Excellent. Well, Tanios, you've given us some really good information on esophageal cancer. Can you summarize our discussion maybe with two or three key points?
Yes, certainly. So thank you for the opportunity again. I think most important key points here is, one, the importance of identifying clinical risk factors that can increase the risk of cancer of the esophagus and essentially screen those patients at risk sooner with organized screening, which will allow early detection of the cancer and ultimately improving survival. The other key point is, you know, depending on the stage of the cancer, the options would include either curative options in the earlier stages with enhancing or establishing the role of chemotherapy, radiation, and surgery, and now more and more immune therapy. And very importantly, in most advanced stages of the cancer, the armamentarium of therapies available to us continue to expand significantly. And a lot of it will depend on essentially screening the tumors for the right target and for many of these patients being able to match the target to a therapy that's available in the clinic. So it's a very exciting time, I think, in cancers of the esophagus, all the way from early detection to later stage treatment.
We've been discussing esophageal cancer with oncologist Dr. Tanios Bikais from the Mayo Clinic. Tony, thank you so much for sharing your expertise with us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
You can now listen to several hundred different medical topics developed for primary care providers on Mayo Clinic Talks podcasts. Find them at ce.mayo.edu or your favorite podcasting app. If you've enjoyed Mayo Clinic Talks podcasts, please follow us. We're honored to have you as a listener and invite you to tune in again next week. Stay well.